From KCRW, I'm Justin Simeon.
And I'm Barry Jenkins.
And you're listening to
Don't At Me.
Podcast voice. What's going on? Okay, so I'm really excited because today I'm talking to the man.
Oh, God.
Barry Jenkins, the black man who stole the Oscar from white America for his amazing film. That's a very controversial introduction.
I'm glad this is radio.
I'm kidding. But I mean, okay, I'm just going to get into it. I'm not going to give a fancy introduction because I have to say, like, a lot of my stuff is your fault because I was so jealous of whoever this asshole who made Medicine for Melancholy was, because I was like, how dare you be black and brilliant before I've had my chance? You know, I was still in that, like, you know, crabs in a barrel and I didn't know you. I kind of got pretty obsessed with you because you were part of, like, the science fiction PBS thing. What was that called?
Future States, yeah.
Future States, and I thought your short there was amazing.
Thank you, man.
And I'd seen a few of your shorts and stuff, and I just, like, I was just such a fan. I was such a fanboy. And then when we really got to know each other is you were inviting people to watch Moonlight.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right.
That's
and
how
you,
we...
And you came to, like, I think our first feedback screening.
Yeah, that's, like, how we, like, met, kind of. But we really met. We met on the internet.
Exactly. We met via, like, I think Twitter it was?
Yeah, it was Twitter.
Because I think I was, like, super broke. I just moved back to L.A.
Yeah.
When white people came out.
Uh-huh.
And I
Same,
took,
by the way.
I took, well, yeah, but I took the bus to the mm-hmm, ArcLight mm-hmm. to go and see Dear White People.
Wow, man.
And I remember tweeting at you leaving the movie, which I still do to this day, and you replied. And I was like, oh, shit, this dude replied to me. And then we kind of just started, like, fangirling.
This dude replied to me. Okay, whatever. Whatever, Barry. You know that you're the shit. It's fine. The thing about Moonlight that honestly, like, there was a little explosion in my brain. And it doesn't happen often in the movies, but it happened in your film.
Mm-hmm.
It happened in Get Out. And I think, honestly, before that, it was, like, 2001. Like, it was, like, and it was this feeling that I never thought I could have this experience from a movie. You know, and it wasn't, part of it is the subject matter, because there are scenes in Moonlight that you just, like, captured aspects of my life, Barry, that, honestly, I had never before even attempted to articulate or think about. And it was so powerful. I felt so seen watching that movie. You know, so first of all, really honestly, thank you for the film.
Thank you.
I can't, like, I'm so happy that it won, because I thought it really was the best film that anyone made that year. You've talked about Moonlight. You've talked about the origin story. But I'm curious, like, what does it feel like for you, of all people, to sort of be, you know, this kind of, like, lighthouse, this beacon in the queer community, which I feel like you, I guess, I don't even know if I would consider you an outsider,
yeah,
but you're an observer, I would say, in that space.
Yeah, definitely an observer in that space, and it was something I didn't anticipate when we made the film. You know, it's interesting, because there are certain scenes that originated in the play, and then certain scenes that I had to add, you know, as we were building out the life of Chiron, building out the world of the film. And I'm kind of thankful now, looking back on it, that I never considered how unseen this character was, and how unseen certain moments in this boy's life were as far as arts and letters or mainstream cinema goes. Because had I known, I think I would have felt this weight, this burden, this pressure. And I think it's interesting you used the term outsider. I feel like there was just enough distance between myself and what we were doing, but so much proximity for Terrell and the source material, that it just kind of created this blend where I think the art could stand on its own outside the subject matter, but there's no denying the subject matter came from a very potent, personal place.
I think it doesn't ever feel like propaganda.
Exactly.
It doesn't ever feel overtly political,
but
I mean, it's profoundly political, of course, because these are stories that traditionally are not told in cinema, which, you know, is really kind of like, that's the tops, you know what I mean, in terms of us as humans right now. When a kind of story makes it to the cinema mm-hmm. and wins an Oscar. I mean, that is like, that's at the top of our culture. Yeah. So I can feel that in the movie because the movie is never trying to convince me of anything or mm-hmm. tell me anything other than, you know, what's going on with these particular characters.
Yeah.
And I really just so appreciate it.
Yeah.
And it makes me,
you know, it's one of those things where I moved to San Francisco in like 2005, 2006. Mm-hmm. And I had never spent, you know, any considerable amount of time, I would say, immersed in the LGBTQ community, mm-hmm. or at least immersed in a city where one of the dominant cultures was a culture that was founded or rooted, you know, in LGBTQ themes. And it was a growing process for mm-hmm, me. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I worked with people who very openly identified as LGBTQ.
I'm going to pause you there.
Yeah.
How do you politely decline all of the wedding proposals that I'm sure you're getting from men across the country? By the way, I get texted about this more than anything. Like, hey, can you give me Barry something? I was like, he's not interested, dude. Like, that's not, he's a filmmaker. He made this movie.
My Instagram, like, you know, the messages of people you don't follow has consistently just been popping.
Out of control.
Ever since the first screening or
the
first
review.
There
are people who would, like, die to have your Instagram inbox.
I literally posted a photo today because I'm watching the World Cup of me in a Peru soccer jersey, and some guy was like, Barry Jenkins looking like a snack.
Wow. Well, oh, you're welcome. Man. We're disgusting.
But I've also gotten, you know, some of the sweetest responses I think I will ever get. When I say sweet, I mean just most heartfelt, viscerally human responses to a piece of work that I've ever gotten. You know, I have had men, you know, approach me and literally just fall into my arms.
Wow.
Just shaking, basically. Wow. For exactly the reasons you said at the top of the show, which is for the first time they feel like they've been seen. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing for other people to see them for the first time, but for them to also see themselves.
Yeah.
And I think portrayed in what I think is a very humane and delicate way in the film, which is interesting given how hard the world Chiron grows up in and how hard Trevante Rhodes makes himself in the last chapter of the film.
You know what I also got to give you is you never make a point to talk about how straight you are. Like, it's a thing, but you know what I mean? It's like a thing that it's ubiquitous. Like, every straight actor that plays gay or like a straight person that sort of, you know, does something artistic in the gay space, there's always like, they always slip it in either at the top or in the middle or at the end. Like, you know, well, I'm not gay, I'm my fiance. Or they'll like, you know, they'll just make a point to bring it up. So just so people know.
I've never
heard you do that.
I kind of felt I've had to say it as an apology because it's almost like, I feel like there are people who, which is how it should be. You know, I think there are people who have engaged the art in such an aggressive way, who have engaged Moonlight in such an aggressive way. And then I come secondarily. Mm-hmm. And I see it all the time on Twitter where somebody will say something and then somebody in their mentions will be like, well, you know, he's actually not gay.
Yeah.
And that person will just be like, what?
I have had text conversations with people I have not talked to in years. So I'm like, listen, it's not going to happen. I'm so sorry. Okay, so I want to talk about this really quickly. But mm-hmm. we will do that after the break.
Yes.
You're listening to Justin talking to Barry frickin' Jenkins on Dun
Justin
Abbey.
Simeon, Academy Award member, talking
hey,
to...
Hey, Academy Award winner.
Hey, we just two black boys in the Academy.
MF-er? All right. We'll be right back. And we're back.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so you've talked this to death, but I still get a lot from it. I want to know about the in-between times. You know, Iyanla Van Zandt of mm-hmm. Fix My Life fame has a book called In the Meantime that I have read cover to cover because I have been in a meantime for most of my life, mm-hmm. and you were in a major meantime between medicine and Moonlight. And I want to know what that was like for you because I was aware that you were a genius from the first time I saw your work. I knew that you were a brilliant filmmaker. So I know you must have known it. Like, how annoying was that? I just tell me the real, like going through that period. Like, talk to me about it.
You know, the real is, you know, I don't think very much of myself. I never have. Mm-hmm. I think it has to do with the way I grew up. And hopefully I'll get better therapy and I can really unpack this mm-hmm. so I can stop saying this. But
are we using like, what kind of therapy are we on right now? Better therapy.
Well, it's interesting. I like don't like paying out of my provider.
Oh, so
and
you're
so and so now well no, I was out, but now I'm trying to come back in. But I want to come back in and find somebody who's good.
It's so hard. My therapist is great.
I might hit you up afterwards, exactly.
I'll let you know.
but yeah, I've never thought that I was very good at anything, or that the stuff I make can have value to anyone else. It's why,
really?
I'm just being honest, man. It's why everything that happened with Moonlight was so shocking to me, and it's why the last year and a half of my life has just been so just odd and strange.
So, what did you think would happen though after Medicine came out? Like after Medicine came out and it went through the box office and it left the box office and it entered home. Like, what did you think the next few years were going to look like then?
I mean, initially, mm-hmm. you know, I thought, okay, I've got an agent now. I've got mm-hmm. a deal at Focus Features. This is it. I'm on my way. I'm gonna do this thing. And then when it didn't happen, mm-hmm. you know, mostly for reasons that I caused myself. You know, I just wasn't doing the best work I could do. I wasn't writing the best things I could write. I wasn't trying to write anything like Moonlight. I felt like it was a self-fulfilling prophecy that here it is. Here's the truth. You know, you made this little thing with your friends and
Damn, Barry. And
it meant a lot to some people. But that's it, you know? And so in the in-between time, I felt like, you know what? Okay. This is it. That thing with Medicine, that was like a mistake.
Wow.
You know? I'm just being dead ass serious.
Oh my goodness, man. That's crazy to hear.
And this is why I love my friends and I continue to work with my friends, because it wasn't my choice to make Moonlight. It wasn't my choice to try to get back in the arena. It wasn't my choice to try to prove myself wrong. It was Adela Romansky, my producer, who called me up and said, "This shit has got to stop. You know, you're too good, you know, to not be doing anything. And I am too pissed. I want to work with somebody I love on something they love. So let's find something you love and let's go and do it."
That is amazing.
And that was about 5 or 6 years after Medicine had come out. Mm-hmm. And so it was pretty much, I mean, you know how it is. It's like I was hot for a second.
Yeah.
And then I was not.
I mean, I was terrified when I went to Sundance about it not being hot. And I had like so many things. I was like killing myself.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was funny. I also, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what this is about, our, what this says about our upbringings. I'm sure it says a lot of obvious things, but you know, I kind of come from a place of scarcity too. And I sort of remembered maybe a year and a half or 2 years after I made the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I was walking by, like I had the poster, the movie poster for Dear White People hanging up in my apartment. And I looked at it and I was like, oh my God, I fucking did that. Mm. And I realized like that was the first time I ever felt pride about the project in the entirety of
I'll tell you a real
raising
story.
The money, doing the trailer, all that stuff, like making it, all of those things that happened. Like I never once felt pride.
I will tell you a real story. I just got back yesterday from the Sundance Labs. I was only there for the weekend because we're finishing a post on Beale Street. But Michelle Satter, who, bless her heart, I love her. Mm-hmm. You know, she basically was like, "You got to come out here. You know, just tell me what's the window you can do." I was like, "I can do 2 days, a Saturday and Sunday." She's like, "All right, we're doing it." And then like 3 days before, she's like, "And we're going to show Moonlight." And we're going to do a Q&A with the fellows. And so, you know, I did my advising. And then Sunday night, we showed the film. I haven't watched it in forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't watch it this time. But, you know, I crept back in the last 20 minutes. Couldn't even stand in the theater. I had to like go stand in the projection booth and
really?
Watch it on the projection booth screen. It's hard for me to watch. But for the
because
first,
you still see mistakes.
Well,
is that what it is?
Not only that. See, that's what I say externally.
Okay.
I still see mistakes.
Uh-huh.
But I also, I have this fear of watching it and going, you know what? It's all bullshit.
Yes.
You know?
I get that.
It's not a good film. And everybody's saying it's a good film, but it's not a good film.
Mm-hmm.
And if I don't watch it, I don't have to confront this idea that maybe it's not a good film.
Wow,
maybe
man.
It's not all these things, which is fine for me because the feeling of making it was so rewarding that I can just live in that.
It's not fine though, Barry, because I feel the same way. Hold up. Mm-hmm. I feel the same way. I remember every time I would walk into the end of Dear White People and I would like you know, once I heard a laugh or once I heard like a line hit the way it hit that one other screen, then I would sort of go like, okay, I think it's like working. I think I got him. I think I'm like, you know, mm-hmm. I think I got him confused. I think like, you know, mm-hmm. I think I tricked him. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Mm-hmm. But I have to say my journey after the film where I really had to confront my own depression and how long I've had it and all that kind of stuff. It's not okay. It's not good enough because you are one of the greats and you have to push yourself to be better. I know that that's part of your process and that mm-hmm. you will always do that. And I want to talk about that next, but I need you as Justin Timmy, your friend and supporter and fan. I do need you to find a way to take in how great you are because, at a certain point, those like, I'm not good enough and I have to always be better things, they stop working for us at a certain point.
No, for sure.
And all of our favorite filmmakers, you can see it. Like, mm-hmm. You can see it working up until a point. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then you see it start to backfire. Yeah. And you're like, whoa, Eyes Wide Shut took 8 years to make? You know what I mean? And sort of like... And so I just want to say that because you're one of the ones, man. You're one of the ones on the wall, okay? You're one of the brothers on the wall. Mm-hmm. And I just want to tell you that. And I also want to segue into what it is that you're chasing. I want to talk about Beale Street. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about you as a filmmaker after Moonlight. But what is what's that carrot that you're chasing? You know, like, because the thing I relate to about what you said is like, oh, I didn't get it this time, but I'm going to get it next time. Mm-hmm. So what's that next time? What are you chasing as a filmmaker?
You know, for me, I feel like in the simplest terms, I'm always chasing the feeling that other films gave me, you know. Mm. I'm not chasing in the mood for love, but I'm chasing the feeling that it gave me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not chasing 2001, but I'm chasing the feeling that it gave me, which was, this is so massively, massively more cosmic, more humane, more just everything mm-hmm. than I feel like I could ever intellectually coerce into a piece. So I'm like, did he do that intentionally or is it just magic, you know? You know, same thing with like something like Do the Right Thing, you know, mm-hmm. with Beau Travail, you know? I feel like I'm like chasing not necessarily those films as a whole, but just like this feeling, this, I guess in a very childlike way, the sense of awe mm-hmm. that they gave me. I think that's a very simple thing to chase.
No, but it's the thing.
It's the thing,
ain't
you know?
It the thing? Yeah.
And I think it might be a trick that I'm playing on myself, but I've convinced myself that there's no organized way to arrive at that. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always trying to stay fresh and stay just open to the possibility of everything. Mm-hmm. And I think it's what's been a little bit difficult about, you know, the post-Moonlight filmmaker, which is now people are watching and there's all these expectations, but you can't be aware of them because if you are, then you're not chasing that elusive awe. You know, that was the original impetus for me wanting to do this in the first place.
And what are the tactics? What are the techniques? Like, how do you chase the awe? How do you get what's fresh?
You know, I try to be a termite, man. I still mm-hmm. program the short films at Telluride, you know, which means mm-hmm. I'm watching like 300-400 short films this summer, you know?
That's actually brilliant, dude.
And those things.
I never thought of it that way at all.
Well, I'm like a vampire. I mean, it's great. I'm doing this altruistic thing. I'm trying to give these filmmakers a platform to announce themselves, but I'm also trying to just suck the blood of them because they're coming from such interesting perspectives.
What new things have you come up with?
Bruh, I'm telling you, every year the most interesting shit I see are the short films that I'm watching, programming mm-hmm. for Telluride. Case in point, this is a great filmmaker named Ava Riley.
Yeah, tell us.
She made a short film that I remembered from like 3-4 years ago. And I was like, I just want to watch this short film again. You know, I need a little fresh shot of energy. And so I sent her a DM on Twitter. I was like, hey, I need a link to this short film. You know, do you have it? And she sent it. And I was like, okay, yeah, this is dope. So stuff like that, man. But really, and also too, I feel like when you reach down to like the filmmakers who are just starting, that sense of awe, they are just driven by it.
They still have it too.
And it's so reflected in the work. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Damn, you're not lying, man, because I mean, I remember when I first got into it, I was a little kid. Like, how old were you when you realized film was the thing?
I mean, I wasn't a little kid. I was like 20, 21, you know?
I was kind of a little kid.
That's true. Thinking back on it. But then I think about my classmates at the time. Like, this dude, Wes Ball, was a classmate of mine. And Wes does the Maze Runner movies and is going to do so much more. But he clearly, like, he was 3 years old and mm-hmm. he knew. And he had just been like working it since he was like 4 or 5 years old. And you could see it in the work, even in film school. Whereas I feel like I was a late bloomer, a late starter, you mm-hmm. know. But like you, I think because of that, I was like, well, I don't have to start from the same point everyone else does.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go and find, you know, all the foreign, all the esoteric, you know, all the weird filmmakers, and I'm going to start my voice from this place. I'm going to make my box that much bigger, you know?
That's amazing. Do you have, like, really embarrassing first films?
Yes and no, but I don't have them.
They exist somewhere in the universe, maybe?
There's a couple of them, yeah. Okay. But my first official short, I put up on my Twitter profile. Not that it's dope. You know, I love it, and I'm proud of it.
I'm going to watch it. I haven't watched it yet.
And I have no problem with people, young filmmakers who find me, you know, if you want to know where I started from, you know, not my first semester project, but maybe like my third semester project.
My shit was so out there and pretentious, but it was different, you know, and everybody was trying to make Pulp Fiction or Donnie Darko. I mean, that's what it was in film school, or Reservoir Dogs or something.
Yeah, for me, it was Wes Anderson. Yes. Everybody in film school was trying to make, it was like this Tallahassee version of Wes Anderson or Charlie Kaufman. And I'm like, you can't do either one of those things this city.
I love Wes Anderson, but I'm so annoyed at the comparison. I get compared to him, especially with the film.
What?
Because I also will operate in flat spaces. You know what I'm saying? I will also sort of have characters kind of facing direct towards lens.
Mm-hmm.
And there are moments in Dear White People that are everything in the frame is just so.
Yes. And Wes Anderson is amazing.
Amazing.
Amazing. Amazing.
Amazing.
Not the originator of any of those techniques.
That's what, and I think, and that's the thing, it's like, I pulled a lot of stuff from Fritz Lang. Like, that's my sort of, like, silent film god. Obviously, like, there's Hitchcock, but
Justin,
but
you're
Fritz
a
is
black
the one,
queer filmmaker.
How
you can't
dare
be
you
referencing Fritz Lang.
How?
You can't.
I know, I have
you
to
can't
reference, I'm not smart enough.
You can't.
So I have to reference a filmmaker that has come out in the past decade, because assumptions. But truly, it's that silent tradition of creating these kind of flat, almost animated 2D scenes.
Mm-hmm.
That's where that came from for me.
I have worked on your show, so I have gotten the Justin Simeon visual lookbook that the director gets when they start. So trust me, I know.
Speaking of which, I love the way you directed. We'll be right back with my guest, Barry Jenkins. You're listening to Don't At Me with Justin Simeon. We're back. All right. So I want to talk very, very quickly about your time on Dear White People. Because, I mean, I'm telling you, man, it's like going to film school. It's like I love directing. Like, that's my favorite thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I also really love watching over the shoulder people like you.
Watching over the shoulder? You were fucking with me, man.
I was. It was fun.
So this is my first time doing a TV show. And Justin said, do what you want to do.
Which is true.
No, totally true. But you were fucking with me, because sometimes I would want to do things that were a little outside the box.
Uh-huh.
And I would look over my shoulder and see you watching me. And I'd go, Justin, do you mind if I... And then Justin, this motherfucker, he would give me this look and he wouldn't say nothing. And then he'd laugh and he'd be like, Barry, shut up. This is your episode. Go
favorite,
and do what you do.
My favorite was like walking by and be like, yeah, I wouldn't do it that way, but okay. but in reality,
I think that was in the house too. And that shit was so stressful. I was like,
yeah,
Justin,
oh my
no,
God, the gun scene.
Not right now.
I know.
No.
I'm so sorry. I'm like literally the worst. So just to summarize for the people listening, so Barry directed episode or chapter 5 of volume 1 of Dear White People. And this kind of was the moment where the show, it really does, it's a shifting moment for the show. We sort of walk and talk with these characters for about a half hour, and then at the end of it, all of these little signs that things are different for black people at Winchester really come to a head when Reggie has a gun pointed at him by a security guard. And it really is one of the most talked about, it's the most talked about episode, I would say, of the first season. For me, that's where the show concretizes into what the show really is, which is it's lighthearted, it's fun, but black comes at you fast. It's also honest.
Yeah. Did you say life comes at you fast? Or
black
comes at you
black
fast. That's what I thought.
Yeah. Boom, you're black. That's how it feels anyway. But, you know, so that was the episode that you did. And but for me, it's like going to film school, because you direct, like the way you are on set it's a very specific Barry Jenkins kind of thing. And I just was like a sponge because, you know, I'm not a guy who thinks like everyone needs to come in with a shot list or a storyboard. Like everyone's mm-hmm. different. And mm-hmm. you come in with, this is how I've described it to people. You come in with like this kind of mastermind understanding of all the little bits and parts of the scene. And none of us can ever see the playbook that mm-hmm. you have somewhere deep in the back of your mind. Mm-hmm. But I can see you twisting this screw over there and like moving this thing here and like, you know, yelling at this AD over here and pushing this person over there. Like I can see you exacting your master plan, even though you sometimes don't reveal it mm-hmm. because I don't know why, but what I notice is it tends to get a very kind of surprised, organic, kind of emotional response from the actors. Like, exactly. It really does feel as if they're living this stuff for the first time. Yeah. And when you see it, and when you see it edited back, it's like, oh, this motherfucker had this all planned from jump. But in the moment, you're sort of like, hey, guys, we're just in here playing, da-da-da-da-doop, don't worry about it.
Which is what I'm always trying to do, and especially with your crew and that cast, they just love to play. It was, mm-hmm. I mean, the first day...
They do love to play.
...was really tricky, because we were doing all that stuff out in the front on the front lawn with the light changing, and I was like, yeah. Ooh, I don't know, this is not my world. And then as the days went on, it was like very clear, oh, this crew is really fast. I don't know if the season two crew was the same as season one, but really fast crew, mm-hmm. like holy shit. And it felt like I could be empowered to do exactly what you said. And it's not that I can't see from A to Z, but depending on how B goes, C might be a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to burden the crew with like
thinking about all those other things.
Exactly, yeah. Before we get there. Especially with that crew, because they were just so organically just like flowing with the organism as it was taking shape.
Well, I love it because it was, you know, you gave me exactly what I wanted, which is, you know, here's the melody. Like the pilot mm-hmm. is the melody. The film is the melody. But mm-hmm. now I want jazz. Like now I want you to give me mm-hmm. harmonies and notes and things that sort of blend with this melody, but mm-hmm. take me in a place that I am surprised by. And there were so many scenes, because your episode, I've talked about this before, but mm-hmm. your episode really was inspired by a chunk of the film that I never shot.
That's right.
And I always had an idea of what it would be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, seeing it in your hands, it still surprised me. And it was so exciting. It was just really exciting to see what you do with that.
Well, no, I have to be honest, though. I mean, you did trick me.
I did? Because
you came and saw Moonlight.
I did.
And I remember it was like we were at that party that Tommy threw. Mm-hmm. Was at. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then you said to me, hey, you know.
You're talking about Tommy Oliver.
Tommy Oliver. Exactly. And Tahir was there. I remember you saying, hey, I got this episode, dear white people. I would love you. It's like Medicine for Melancholy.
Your impression of me,
it's just
by
people
the way.
Walking.
I never know myself to talk like
that. Yeah, but the message was, it's just people walking and talking. It'll be real chill. Because I think we both knew.
Did I say chill?
Yes, you did.
Because oh, I think
we
I
both
lying.
Knew it would have to be during the release of Moonlight.
Oh, I did probably downplay the work.
Because these were the only 10 days I had off from pushing Moonlight was mm-hmm. the 5 days of prep on this and the 5-day shoot.
Yep.
And I remember like 2 weeks out, I got the script. Mm-hmm. And I was like, whoa, what is all this shit that happens on page 18?
Well, okay, I will say this. That was not decided at the time.
Okay.
The Reggie climax in that episode, I knew that in episode 5, when I first sold the show, I wanted somebody to get shot. Mm-hmm. I wanted a very specific character, in fact, to get shot. Mm. And the studio and my showrunner, everyone just like, don't do that. We need this character. Don't let them go. Mm-hmm. And so I said, okay. And so then we had a much softer thing that happened with Coco, actually, in that episode. But then we sort of, you know, life was happening and people were getting shot by the cops every day. Mm-hmm. I think it was the day after the Philando video had hit Facebook. Mm. And we just all sat and looked at each other and was like, what the fuck are we doing? We have to do, mm-hmm. we have to do the gun thing. Like, we mm-hmm. have to talk about it. This is still why it's fatal to be black almost wherever you are in the country.
Yeah.
And so we swapped the character out and we didn't make it, you know, someone getting shot and killed, mm-hmm. but it still felt like it had, because we tried to treat it honestly, it still had an emotional resonance. So some of that stuff I did not know, actually, when I was pitching the episode to you.
Yeah,
I genuinely
right.
did. I swear. No, I swear, because at that point I had already sort of given in to the, you know, the people asking me not to kill off a certain character.
Well, and I'll say the thing for me then is, you know, thank you, you know, and Tara Duncan and just everybody between...
Shout out to Tara Duncan.
Shout out to Tara Duncan between Lionsgate and Netflix for trusting me with the episode. I don't think many of them had seen Moonlight at that point.
None of them had seen it.
I know you had seen it. And so for them, it was like, oh, this Medicine for Melancholy guy is going to do this episode?
Well, there's always that thing where if someone hasn't done quote-unquote comedy or something, like everyone's like, well, are they... You know, what people don't realize is that there's really not... The difference is a difference of tone, but mm-hmm. it's not... I don't know that it requires like wildly different skill sets if that director can work within the aesthetic of the show or the aesthetic of the film or whatever.
Well, and bro, I want to say two things. One, that is the most emotional I've ever been on a set. Mm-hmm. That is the most emotional film set I've ever been on.
Same.
And that includes Moonlight and Beale Street. That night in that house, and I know you know what I'm talking about,
yes.
It was so, I mean, it was just beyond emotional. I mean, I just can't even begin to... describe what that was like. And I remember getting on a plane literally the next morning and flying to New York to screen Moonlight at the New York Film Festival, and I was still in Dear White People. I just, my body was just still there. The other thing is, the first act of Beale Street is actually kind of funny, and I think my time working on Dear White People helped me get more comfortable directing things of that tone. So,
well
so
I
shout out to
wait
you, bro.
I cannot wait to talk about Beale Street. We will be back. We will be right back with Barry Jenkins. You're listening to Don't At Me with Justin Timmy. And we're back. Okay. Beale Street, dude. I'm so excited about this movie. You know, oh, God, it's like it's the coming together of so many things I'm excited about. First of all, you didn't direct an episode of season two because you had to make this movie.
I know.
You
I'm
also
sorry,
stole
bro.
Regina King from me,
I
who
know.
Was also slated to direct the episode.
I know.
But
I'm so
it was
sorry,
all
bro.
Okay because you and all these brilliant people are making a James Baldwin movie, but mm-hmm. a movie based on a piece by James Baldwin. I want to know everything. I want to know what brought you to the project. I want to know about this thing that you're chasing, how you were finding. I want to know, man. Tell me about this movie.
You know, I remember first being introduced to James Baldwin by an ex-girlfriend mm-hmm. who broke up with me and said, you need to read James Baldwin.
Was this the reason she broke up with you?
It wasn't the reason. The reason was I was a young, dumbass, immature, not ready for
you
this woman.
You don't know James
man.
Baldwin.
Exactly. No, she said, you need to read James Baldwin.
Wow.
You know, which was, to me, you need to develop yourself as a man, mm-hmm. as a person, as a human being. So I read The Fire Next Time in Giovanni's Room.
Oh my God.
And then it was a few years before a friend passed me If Beale Street Could Talk, which is one of Baldwin's lesser-known works. And mm-hmm. I had actually never heard of it or read it. And once I did, I just knew. I was like, this is a film. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a film that I see and I feel. And that was way back in 2010, 2011.
And what's for people who don't know, like, what's the quick synopsis of what it's about?
Yeah, If Beale Street Could Talk is a Harlem set romance in the early 1970s, and it's about this girl named Clementine Tish Rivers and her boyfriend slash fiance, Funny Hunt. And they are just like the purest, youngest love you could ever imagine. I'm talking like black ass family, church, Al Green, spirituals, mm-hmm. just like everything.
Just black as can be.
Just black as can be. And then, of course, because it's black as can be, like you said, black comes at you fast. Fonny gets arrested for a crime he did not commit. And so it's James Baldwin in some ways doing a procedural. But I remember growing up in Miami, and there were all these stories about these black boys, age 10, age 12, age 13, being tried as adults. For these crimes.
Yeah.
And whenever you would see them in the newspapers, you would just see them as an adult being tried for a crime. You would never see the boy they are, the boy they were. You would never really contextualize them. And so you didn't have any choice but to accept that they were these animals who had committed these adult-like crimes. And for me, when I read Beale Street, Baldwin does this beautiful thing that only he can do with language, where you see the present predicament the people are in, but you see it through the context of their full humanity. So he's telling the story of this very, very deep, pure love, while at the same time taking our culture, our country, especially our judicial system to task. And it's a very potent, evocative, strange mix of tones and genres. And again, it was something that scared the shit out of me.
Which means you got to do it.
Which is why you got to do it. But also, too, there's something about the language of Baldwin that reaches this level of literary awe that I'm always trying to capture cinematically. So
I feel like nobody ever, honestly, there are so many instances that come up on a daily basis where I can think of no one who articulated it better than him, particularly in these trying times of the Trump administration.
Well, and
he broke all of this down for us.
He broke all of it down, and it's still applicable. Like, just about every damn thing, you know, which is why a story that's set in 1973, 1974 still feels so relevant to 2018.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure will in 2028 and 2038.
Because he gets down to the root of it.
Exactly.
He doesn't sort of stay at the surface. He gets down to the root, like the ancestral beginnings of the country.
And what is at the root of America? The blood of black folks.
The blood of black and brown folks.
Black and brown, native folks, yes. Mm-hmm. Blood, blood, blood. What's homegirl say? Blood on the leaves.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it really, you know, it's...
By homegirl, I mean Nina Simone.
Of course.
I apologize to any of the
grown folks. By homegirl, Barry Jenkins, of course, meant Zora Neale Hurston. Because that's who you meant, right?
And Toni Morrison. Let's just shout out all the homegirls.
Lengths and all of them.
By which you respectfully mean our elders.
Yes. All right, so back to Bill Street, though.
Yes.
You know, so you have this amazing story, you have this amazing book, you go about adapting it into a film.
Mm-hmm.
What is your process to figure out, okay, how do I capture this literary awe, but in cinema? Like, what's that for you?
You know, it was tricky because the book is nonlinear, so I'll speak purely in story terms. The book is nonlinear, and there's this amazing freedom you can arrive at when you're working that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think, as you said, Baldwin is mostly concerned about the root. He's not concerned with story progression. He's not concerned with plot. He's like, what's at the root? And what's the feeling at the root? And for me, in translating, especially because this is only the second time Baldwin's ever been translated, the first time in English, it was important to me to not muck up the source, to sort of preserve, again, I'll mention this again, this awe, the literary awe that Baldwin creates his work, the prism he creates his work through. And so it was interesting about cherry-picking in a certain way, but cherry-picking in a way that would still align or overlap with this feeling of awe that I get from the book, from the source material. And then, as you said, describing me on set, trying to find a way to give the actors enough where they could also flow in that same kind of awe, but not with the very typical... knowledge of, okay, I came from A and now I'm going to C. And then after C, I'll be at D. It's like, no, this one kind of doesn't function that way. You know, the feeling of A.
So you tried to create these moments. Is that what you're saying?
A cascading series of moments, you know, that is sort of woven together by the spine of, shockingly, in a Baldwin universe, a crime procedural. So it was a very delicate dance.
I cannot wait to see this movie.
You know, there are times when it is so searingly evocative that I look at it and I go, how did that happen? You know? But then sometimes I look back at the book and I go, oh, wait, how did that happen? And I can't rhyme a reason either one of them.
Are you happy with the film?
I am. I am.
That's good to hear.
I am. It is black as hell.
Yeah.
It is black. We had a preview, and I swear, Justin, at a certain point, a man stood up in the auditorium and just started snapping his fingers.
Woo! Lord Jesus, I cannot wait for this movie.
But it's Baldwin, and we preserve the language. So there is some shit said in this film that is just so real, so fire. It's just like,
damn.
I mean, yeah, we shall see.
I'm so excited. You know, so don't at me, you know, it really comes from, it's when you want to say something publicly, or you want to say something, and you don't want a bunch of people up in your mentions, well, no, I don't actually believe, you know, think piece in you, it's like, can I just say this real quick and just have it sit for a second? That's what don't at me is all about. So I'm going to ask you a couple questions.
Okay.
You can say don't at me to one of them.
Okay. To only one of them?
To only one of them.
How many of them are there?
I'm going to give you three.
Okay, cool.
Okay?
You give me all three, or
I'm going to give them to you one at a time.
Okay, cool.
You can say, you can not answer one of them.
Okay.
But you won't know what's coming next.
Cool.
And all you have to do is say, don't at me.
Okay, cool.
Okay? So first question, what is the best movie ever made?
Ooh, man. The best movie ever made? Damn. I got three movies in my head right now.
Okay, well, which one's the best, Barry?
Damn, you ain't supposed to say that. You're supposed to say, well, tell me all three, bro.
Mm-mm. Which one's the best? You can say don't at me, but then there's two more questions.
No. I think, damn. Shit. In the Mood for Love is the best movie ever made.
In the Mood for Love. Okay, don't add them now. All right, second question. What is the most overrated movie?
Don't at me.
Okay. Well, here's the third question. Yeah, but you're going to be mad.
I said it slow,
but you're going to be mad.
I said it quickly.
You're going to be mad right now, though. What is a movie that got great reviews that you absolutely hated in the past year or so?
In the past year or
so? Like in the past cycle of movies.
Damn, bro.
Yeah. You already used your donut. So great reviews, but you hate it.
Great reviews, but I hate it.
I hated It. I'll tell you that. I hated the It remake.
I didn't see it, though, you know? So it has to be a movie I saw. You know,
yes.
You can't hate something you didn't see.
No, it has to be a movie you saw.
You know what? I don't know if it got great reviews, but I'm going to get so much shit for this. What's that that Michael Bay movie with...
You're not going to get shit for this.
With Homeboy? who I like, Krasinski.
Shit, I don't know.
It's about
he was like in
hours,
war,
13 hours or something like that.
I'm gonna be really honest with you.
So I went and saw.
Yes, wasn't it? I think it was. Was it 13 hours, y'all?
Yeah,
there's like a group of people.
13 hours, and it's about the thing that happened.
War and Krasinski or something.
Yeah, I mean it's a big controversy, and it's part of the reason why the president right now is the president, because Secretary of State Clinton.
Oh, that's right. It was about Benghazi.
Exactly.
It was Benghazi.
Benghazi.
That's right.
So anyway, so I went and saw this film.
That did not get good reviews, by the way.
No, I think it did. I think it got pretty decent reviews. You know?
Okay.
Man, see, you threw me with this don't at me shit.
I know.
You threw me. You can see I'm flustered
now.
That's
fun.
I don't like speaking negatively about things. I do that with my inside voice, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. I think there's just enough negative stuff in the world without me bringing my
I don't
negative
disagree,
shit.
But... I don't disagree, but here's my thing. I do think that there is something to be said.
And it is a bit false because people never see, you know, people think I like everything. And I'm like, no, I just only talk about the shit I like.
That's you know? The same way I do.
So here's my thing. So I'm watching this movie because I actually like action films a lot. I'm going to the premiere of Soldado.
Nice.
Because despite some very harsh criticisms I have of the first Sicario, and if you want to know about those criticisms, look up the review of it in Clio Journal. Which is this awesome women-focused film criticism website based out of Toronto. They view and review films. It's either, a female critic or it's viewing the film through the prism of, you know, the female gaze. Really interesting journal. Anyway, I went and saw this film, 13 Hours, a Michael Bay film, because I like action movies a lot more than people know. I actually like movies that are sort of fact-based. And in this movie, which is really well made, of course, it's Michael Bay, it's really exciting, it's the heart rate pumping. There was a tall, gorgeous, or I'll say, air quotes, physically attractive blonde woman mm-hmm. who plays like the CIA or military, like intelligence person. Mm-hmm. And yet, Michael Bay chooses to dress her in like high heels. She's really ridiculous. She has almost like no street smarts, no sense of awareness. And all the men in the film are just constantly like either making jokes at her or correcting her from doing really simple, dangerous shit
right.
when they're in this war zone and they're trying to be inconspicuous. So anyway, there's a moment like 80 minutes into the film where this huge firefight is raging. And this woman, in a wide shot, like a 35-millimeter lens, is crossing the roof of this building as people are shooting at everyone. And she takes this, like, Busby Berkeley pratfall, just, like, in the middle of a war
Jesus
zone.
Christ.
And I literally stood up in the arc light, and I said...
And you snapped your fingers.
I said, are y'all gonna sit here and watch this shit?
You said that out loud?
Out loud, with my outside voice.
Oh, my God.
I
see movies with Barry Jenkins.
And I walked out, and I just felt like how... Like, how did this conception of this character...
You know how.
I know. But it just, it pissed me off so much.
Yeah.
And I just could not finish watching the film.
Well, God bless you for thinking that you could when you went in there in the first place.
I know,
that's the shadiest thing I've ever... It's actually not even close to the shadiest thing I've ever said.
But anyway, so there's that, man.
All right. Well, look.
Justin got me to publicly share some shade.
I don't think anybody... First of all, that wasn't even shade. It was actually a pretty good read. And I don't think anyone's going to fault you for that, to be honest with you. You know, I think it's really good to talk about movies. I think it's important to say that, like, just because someone doesn't like a movie doesn't mean a movie is bad.
True.
One of my favorite... First of all...
See, that's how I could answer the question.
Yeah.
this movie did very well, but it wasn't for me.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yeah, okay. But I like saying it in the shadier way. Speaking of shade, I'll close with this. I've been shaded from beyond the grave by my favorite filmmaker, Stanley Kubrick. So I'm reading the 2001 book, which mm-hmm. you will love. Okay. It's about the making of the movie. Mm-hmm. It sort of chronicles Arthur C. Clarke and Kubrick's collaboration from its early stages all the way through the film coming out. And you get just an insight into both of them that is just so fabulous and delicious. But one of the things that Kubrick says in the book is he throws shade at filmmakers who also fancy themselves cultural commentators. So shade received Kubrick. Mm. He's talking about me, Barry. Mm. So my house father has shaded me from beyond the grave, but it's okay.
I thought you were going to say something way worse.
So, oh, yeah. So all good. It's slight. So it's just slight. Good. But for me personally, that stung a little
yes,
bit.
For
I was
you
like,
personally.
Stan.
You know, I will say I'm a big Dawn of the Dead fan. Uh-huh. And like, literally, like, honestly, like a month before he passed away, there was an interview with George Romero. Uh-huh. This was during award season. And he was like, you know, La La Land was amazing. It was fantastic. That Moonlight, ugh.
What?
Awful.
Stop.
Yeah. And there was this guy who just hated Moonlight so much. And he made a point of tweeting everything negative anybody said about
it. Oh, I remember that guy. No, yeah. I remember that guy on Twitter. I remember him. And it was so good when you won.
I know. But he sent me this Romero quote. And then Mr. Romero passed away like a month later.
Well, that's sad.
Yeah.
All right, Barry, thank you so much for being with me, man. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, bro.
Now that we've had this chat, you can at us, okay? Now that it's you've heard all of it, all right? So where can they at you, Barry? Where can people find you on the internet should they want to?
Yeah, you can find me at Barry Jenkins on Twitter, which I have to say, I only have that handle because one of my Twitter stans informed me that the person who had that handle for years got suspended. And she was like, you should go get it. And so I used to be Bandry Barry, but now I'm officially Barry Jenkins.
Come on, Barry Jenkins. On yeah, I love it. And when can we hear more about Beale Street? When can we see it?
Soon, my friend.
All right.
Soon, my friend.
All right, dude. Well, thank you for being here. It's always a pleasure.
Appreciate you, man.
Absolutely.
Thank you, young black man.
All right. You've been listening to Don't At Me with Justin Simeon
and Barry Jenkins.
Peace.
Okay, I'm going to do this in the podcast voice. Our producer is Gina Delvac. Our production engineers are Garrett Lang and JC Swadek. Special thanks to Vishnu Vallabhaneni, Gary Scott, head of programming. Of course, Chris Bowers has created our theme song. This is Don't At Me with podcast Justin Simeon. If you like the show or want to think piece me, please subscribe at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave a review. We'd love to hear from you. We'll be back next week with another episode of Don't At Me from the one and only KCRW.